Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Zdravo, and welcome to The Rest is History. Now, you may be wondering why I welcomed you in Serbian. And the answer, Tom, is that we have reached the Balkan Republic in our survey of the countries that have qualified for this year's World Cup in Qatar. You chose to do Serbia. You were very keen to do it.
Yeah, I was.
I would have liked to have done it, but you chose to do it.
What would you have chosen to do?
Oh.
Something involving 20th century coups.
I might have chosen the Black Hand, but you know what, Tom? I'd probably have chosen the Battle of Kosovo Polje.
Okay.
The Field of the Blackbirds. That's probably what I'd have chosen.
Okay.
You're looking deflated with me saying that.
No, not at all. So we obviously, before recording episodes, we have discussed, haven't we, what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So I think I ended up choosing Stefan Dušan, the great 14th century Serbian emperor.
Yeah.
Which is what you may be expecting me to do.
That is what I'm expecting you to do.
But I'm not going to.
Oh, no.
I was really looking forward to that, Tom.
No. I was really looking forward to it.
I've got a totally new one. And the thing that will really excite you about this is that it's prehistory.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
You love a bit of prehistory, don't you? It's not science, it's prehistory.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Your little face lighting up with joy. But Dominic.
Get on with it.
This is actually, this is brilliant, I think. And I'd be interested to see whether you agree.
Okay.
Because basically, where would you say the first script, the first written language originated? Yeah. You might say Sumeria. You might say Mesopotamia. You might say
Egypt.
I'd
probably say near Niš or Novi Sad, somewhere like that in Serbia.
You'd be right. Or would you? Because there is a possibility that the birthplace of written scripts was Serbia.
Okay.
And that Serbia was the home of one of the original great civilizations. Did you know that?
No, I've never heard that claim made before.
A place of urban settlements, the first place to develop copper smelting, perhaps the first place to develop written language. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing that's generally known.
Tom, you've got a bit of work to do to convince me, I'll be frank with you.
Well, it has to be said that it is much debated.
Yeah.
But I think this is a genuinely unexpected. I mean, I hadn't realized this at all. And so I was reading through about Serbian history and came across this and thought, actually, this is much more interesting.
So I had envisaged a Serbian history podcast either involving men with revolvers shooting archduchesses or just a lot of scimitars and the Ottomans lurking in the background.
But what you didn't expect was Serbia as the birthplace of the first great European civilization.
So Serbian listeners are very strong following in Serbia. They'll be delighted by this, Tom.
By and large, the Serbian take on this is at the stronger end of arguing that this is the birthplace of civilization. There are others who are more skeptical. However, so this story begins with a guy called Milhe Vasic, and I hope that I've pronounced his name right. He was a very, very long-lived bloke. He was born in 1869 and he died in 1956. And so he lived through quite a lot of change. Yeah, so he lived through the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the First World War, Second World War, communist period. In these episodes, we've touched on characters who might come from Tintin books quite a lot, haven't we?
Kind of
generals who lead coups and that kind of thing.
People with dark glasses.
Milahay Vasic, if you imagine Professor Calculus, you would not be far wrong. Right. He had a kind of goatee. He was bald, very scholarly. And he was Serbia's first and greatest archaeologist. And this was he was born at a time where there wasn't, I think, a great tradition of archaeology in Serbia. And he went to study in Germany, got his doctorate there, came back to Serbia in 1901. And he was both a museum director in Belgrade, and he ended up professor of archaeology at Belgrade University. So he's absolutely, if you want Serbian archaeology, he is your man. And basically, he was so famous, and he was so much the big man in Serbian archaeology that in various ways he was in post until he was 86.
Crikey.
And he just kept surviving all these regime changes.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter, who was in charge. He was the guy who would be going off and doing his excavations. And he is most famous for excavations at a particular village called Vinča, which is just outside Belgrade. And it's now been basically swallowed up by Belgrade. So it's a kind of suburb now. And the focus of his excavations was a great mound about 12 meters high called Belo Brdo. Again, I hope my pronunciation is right. Dominic, you could help me on that. Is that right?
I think you just have to say it. I think
Belo Brdo.
I don't know anything, Tom. Okay, I mean, I'm just pretending.
But well, you would know, you'd recognize that is in English, the White Hill.
Yeah.
And on the surface, there were remnants of kind of a medieval settlement. So he knew that it was a medieval settlement, but he also suspected that it was a tell. And a tell, it's a word that comes from Near Eastern archaeology. And basically, it's a description of a hill that is just nonstop human settlement. So basically, you dig down and down and down, and the whole way through, it's just kind of human rubbish. And right. So he wanted to know, well, how far can I get down through all this kind of, this layer after layer of cultural debris? And he begins work in 1908. And it gets obviously interrupted by the First World War. So that's bad. And then after the war, the government of Yugoslavia emerges and it's too skint to basically fund his excavations. He has a brief spell in 1924. But then, because word is getting out internationally that the finds that he's making as he goes further and further down through this tell, through these kind of layers of different civilizations, different periods, are really unexpected and fascinating. He gets backing from Britain.
From Britain?
From British, very assorted British businessmen. And so he digs from 1929 through to 31, and the excavations there continue to this day. And what has provoked the interest of these businessmen in Britain is the fact that he has discovered traces of an incredibly sophisticated civilization right at the bottom of this huge, great mound.
Wow.
And what he's found all kinds of fascinating things. He's found ceramics with very complex decorations, kind of swirls and whirls and little symbols. So we'll come back to them.
Yeah.
He's found a lot of sculptural art, including over 2,000 kind of figurative representations, so little figurines. And I was reading a book about this, and in the index, it's a book on the subject, in the index are listed bears, birds, death symbol birds, ducks, frogs, gorgons, hedgehogs, rams, the snake goddess, spirals, stream motifs, and vulvas. So there are little kind of clay images of all those things.
Okay, I'm not going to dwell on some of those. I'm not a massive prehistory person, but that is an extraordinary collection of finding.
Absolutely, well, I'm glad you agree. And once this has been found, people start looking elsewhere and they find kind of, at this layer, similar trace elements. And they find, for instance, evidence of copper smelting. And they find houses, some of which contain two or three rooms and streets. And all these settlements they're centered on Serbia. The arc of them reaches northwards of Serbia and southwards down to the Aegean. They're all by rivers. They're generally 20 or so acres. And the largest have populations up to about 4,000. So, pretty substantial.
4,000?
Pretty substantial.
I mean, that is substantial. Yeah. That's a town. I mean, that's a sizable town. Well, I don't know what time period we're talking about.
Well, so that's the question. That is exactly the question. So when Vasic is excavating, in the 20s and the 30s. This is before carbon dating has been developed. So there's no way of precisely dating them. The only way you can do it is through stratigraphy. So that's the key thing about these mounds with the different layers. You can kind of work it out from that way. So you dig through the medieval layers, the classical layers, and then you're going down. But it's an open question, really, when these are.
Yeah.
And essentially, the best way to do it is to work out, well, are there, you know, say the pottery, do they resemble pots that you might find elsewhere that are more conclusively dated? So Vasich, when he is, you know, he's chiefly got British backers. So he writes an article in 1930 in the Illustrated London News, and he claims that that what he has found is a center of Aegean civilization in the second millennium BC. And he points out, as evidence for this, that the ceramic ware that he has found in his site in Vincia bears similarities to ceramic ware in the earliest layers of Troy. So
Crikey.
He's saying kind of, you know, 1500 BC. And his assumption is that this is an Anatolian settlement, that the people who were responsible for building Troy, that they've kind of spread westwards and colonized Serbia and built these settlements. And this is what it's evidence for. Over the course of his life, he changes his mind about this because he is unsettled by the sophistication of what he's found.
Right.
And he ends up thinking that actually this is a Greek colony, 7th or 6th century BC. And one of the reasons why he comes to this conclusion is that the people who are making these figurines are absolutely obsessed by masks. So again and again, you get these kind of portraits of humans, but they're obviously wearing masks.
Mm.
And the effect is very, very unsettling. So you might have a head with an obviously female hairdo, but a male face. And that's because she is wearing a mask. There are masks that look very, very like the kind of aliens that you get at Roswell. So if you think of the kind of things in the X-Files or whatever, they look very, very similar. You get animal masks with horns, with kind of, you know, ears or whatever. A lot of them imitate birds. So they're very, very, very weird. And I think that Vasich is intrigued with the parallels of the masks that you find on Minoan Crete.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you get masks in Athenian tragedy.
Yeah.
And so he's thinking these are Hellenic, probably.
Can I jump in, Tom?
Yeah.
So he published that article in the Illustrated London News in 1930.
Yeah.
And that's a point where, just think about the political context for his research. Serbia is the dominant partner in the new, what becomes the Yugoslav kingdom, kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, as it becomes. I mean, you know, famously, like all these states in the debris of the Ottoman and Austro-Hungarian empires, very, very nationalistic. But you could see why it would play well in Britain, because, of course, Britain had been Serbia's ally in World War I. So something that bigs up Serbia would have a kind of sentimental appeal. But then he has the argument, first of all, that it's Anatolian, and then later, Greek.
Greek.
And that surprises me, because I would have thought he would say, oh, this is in some sort of indigenous Serbian tradition to which we are really the heirs. Well,
so he's a scholar with an international reputation.
Yeah.
And he is doing best practice. So he's not saying we found this in Serbia, therefore it must be Serbian.
Right.
I think he's alert to the intellectual trends of the age, and this is very much a period, you know, I mean, it's an assumption that is basically true, that a lot of culture, including most obviously agriculture, has come from settlers moving out of the Near East through Anatolia into Europe. And so he's, you know, this is kind of standard explanation at the time.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, his going with the Greek thing is just because he's, you know, he's recognizing that there are possible links to Greek culture. And so this seems the obvious explanation.
Okay. All right.
He's not an overtly nationalist scholar.
Okay.
I mean, he's a proud Serbian, but he's happy to go with what he sees as the evidence.
Yeah.
But then the radiocarbon dating comes in. And the radiocarbon dating reveals something amazing, which is that this stuff is 7,000 years old.
What a twist. So I did not expect.
So the Vincia culture, as it comes to be called, named after this village that he's excavated, but which covers, you know, quite a broad spread of Serbia and beyond into Romania and Bulgaria as well, that these settlements can be dated from 5,700 to 4,200 BC. So that's a millennium and a half of increasingly sophisticated culture. And the implication of that is astounding, basically, in the context of the age, because this implies that this is earlier than, say, Troy. It's earlier than
the Greeks.
Definitely earlier than the Greeks, way, way earlier than the Greeks, but also earlier than, you know, the heyday of the Sumerian civilization, much earlier than the emergence of pharaonic civilization in Egypt. So really, really unexpected. And the elements are definitely those of a kind of proto-civilization, of the kind that, you know, define the riverine civilizations of Mesopotamia or Egypt, say. So you have very, very intensive agriculture, and all these settlements, you know, they're on the edge of rivers. They seem to have been settled there, not so much because there's good game, you know, mm-hmm. so these are not kind of wandering hunter-gatherers. These are people who are settling in places that are agriculturally rich. So because of that, there's no plow has ever been found, but it is all pretty universally accepted that they must have had plows, that they were plowing. They have barley, they introduce wheat, they're planting flax, which they are using to manufacture clothing. And this in turn, as will happen later in Mesopotamia and Egypt, this generates agricultural surplus, which in turn seems to have enabled these really quite large settlements to grow
some markets and towns. And presumably then, if you've got towns and you've got markets, you must have some sort of authority, kings? Or...
Well, we'll come to that. You also have in certain settlements have been built close to seams of copper ore, so evidence for industry. So there's a place called Plochnik in northern Serbia, which is actually first discovered in 1927 when they're developing a railway, but it's only serious excavations in 1996. So these are quite recent and ongoing. And in 2008, they discover a copper axe, which is dated to 5,500 BC. And there's a site, Belovode, in the Rudnik Mountain, mm-hmm. Which apparently is in central Serbia. I'm not sufficiently familiar with
Serbian geography. It off with great aplomb, I have to say.
And what they find there is the world's oldest securely dated evidence of copper smelting.
Wow.
So this is a Neolithic civilization that is entering the copper age. And it seems, as far as we can tell from the archaeological evidence, to be the first culture anywhere that does this. So this is entering the age of metal, and it's happening in Serbia.
Wow.
So that's spectacular enough.
Yeah.
But the most dramatic possibility of all is that the Vinča culture, this unexpected civilization, that it might have developed writing. Because lots of these sites, I mentioned that Vinča itself has the ceramics, the figurines, they're decorated with all kinds of symbols. These start to be found in sites across Serbia and beyond. And lots of them seem to be pictograms of animals. So, rather in the way that, say, Chinese script or hieroglyphs, or indeed that actually the alphabet that we use, you can trace them back to, portraits of oxes' heads or whatever. So there's that. There are swastikas, there are crosses, there are chevrons. And in all, there are about 5,500 of these different symbols. And so people started wondering, well, what do they represent?
Yeah.
And that question is turbocharged by a find that is made in 1961 in a village called Tataria, which I'm afraid for Serbian listeners isn't actually in Serbia. It's in Romania, but very amazing find.
Yeah.
And it's three small tablets, which are just covered with these kind of Vinča symbols. We'll call them the Vinča symbols. And they seem to be arrayed in what looks like a form of writing. And two of these tablets are rectangular, one is round.
Oh my God, Tom. I've just Googled them. They're amazing.
They are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah.
So you can see, so one of the rectangular ones, the round one has holes drilled through it. The one that doesn't have a hole drilled through it has an illustration of a horned animal. Mm. Now, when they're found, they're unbaked. And so what the guy who does it orders is that they should be baked to preserve them.
Okay.
The problem with that is that this process prevents carbon dating.
Oh, no.
So they can't be carbon dated. But the stratigraphy of it is pretty clear. Mm-hmm. They have been found at a layer that points to a date of about 5,500 BC. So around the same time as this copper axe is being manufactured. And these predate Sumerian cuneiform, Egyptian hieroglyphs by about 2,000 years. Wow. So again, I mean, this is stupefying.
Yeah.
However, a lot of controversy surrounds them. And I think that we should probably take a break at this point. And when I come back, I will discuss the controversies.
I have the nasty feeling, Tom, this is one of those podcasts that you do sometimes where you talk for 20 minutes and it's very exciting. Then we take a break and you come back and you say, but.
Well, no, no. They are genuinely mysterious and there is there is a lot of debate around them.
Well, come back after the break and see if Tom does do one of his buts or whether it's still as mysterious.
There is a but. There is a but, but I think it's not an absolutely conclusive but.
Okay, excellent. Come back after the break for a not absolutely conclusive but. See you in a minute.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom has been guiding us through this extraordinarily mysterious story of the Vinča culture in Serbia, found by the archaeologist Milojko Vasić. And Tom, you left us sort of hanging at the end of the first half, talking about the discovery of these tablets, the sense that, you know, this is writing, this is civilization that predates the Sumerian culture or Egyptian, that this, and it all kicked off in Serbia. And then you sort of ended with talk of a however. So what's going on?
Yes. Yeah, so focus specifically on the these tablets from the village of Tataria, where these symbols, they seem to be forming a kind of writing.
Yeah.
So there is controversy around the tablets. I mentioned in the first half that these got baked supposedly to preserve them. And that the effect of that is that you can't carbon date it. And people have argued that this is suspicious. I mean, it's so important to carbon date them. Yeah. And, you know, it's possible that there's a problem with that. People have argued that if they are authentic, if they do come from 5,500 BC, then perhaps they bear the stamp of Sumerian proto-cuneiform. Because this is around 5,500 BC, these sorts of symbols are being developed in Mesopotamia. So perhaps there are links. People have argued that perhaps it got jumbled up in the excavations and actually it comes from a higher layer. So
okay, yeah.
Perhaps it got confused. And there are people who argue that they're straight forgeries. So there's no consensus on that, really.
Forgeries done by, but they were from Romania, not Serbia. So they wouldn't have been forged by Serbian nationalists or something.
But they might be forged by Romanian nationalists or whatever.
I think it's
very much kind of open question on that. But even if we put them to one side and say it's not conclusively proven, and lots of archaeologists and scholars do accept that they're authentic. There are lots who accept that they're authentic. Are they writing? So there's a whole range of things that they could be.
Because they're to give people a sense. They are, I mean, you were talking about them before. There's one circular, two rectangular. They are kind of, there's a picture of what looks like a goat. There's a couple of pictures of, frankly, what look like stools or toilets.
Yeah. There are swastikas, there are crosses, there are kind of there are kind of quite obvious symbols.
Yeah.
But the problem is we just don't have the context that would enable scholars to evaluate them and come to a conclusive conclusion.
Yeah.
So we don't have the equivalent of a Rosetta Stone, obviously, because these are earlier by about 2,000 years ahead of any distinguishable writing system. So they could be, decorations, they could be ownership markings, or they could be some form of early proto-writing.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is that the idea that they might be proto-writing generates incredibly intense passions on both sides.
Right.
So by and large, Serbian nationalists are very, very keen on this idea that Serbia is indeed the birthplace of the earliest form of writing. And there have been kind of on the absolute wacko fringe, there are people who have kind of faked scholarly identities, put out bogus scholarly articles, all kinds of things, arguing that not only is it a form of writing, but it is actually a form of proto-Serbian.
Serbian?
It goes right.
The Slavic language.
Absolutely.
The Slavs weren't even in the Balkans this point.
So there's a professor whose entire career seems to have been invented.
Right.
And he argues that not only is this script found on the Tatarian tablets, proto-Serbian, the Etruscan also is a form of Serbian.
Right. Yeah.
And so he wrote this article in which he claimed the Etruscan word roots are Slovene, and the archaeological documentation for this is so obvious that it cannot be overlooked.
Right.
And the whole story is very, very Umberto Eco. I mean, it's a great story. It seems improbable. But there are absolutely, there are very, very distinguished linguists who take it highly seriously. So there's an article online by a guy called Toby Griffin, who is a professor at Southern Illinois University, a linguist. And he extrapolates from it, from these symbols, words for bird, for goddess, and for bear.
Words? I mean, I'm looking at these symbols and thinking,
well, they're symbols. Who knows what the actual word is?
Yeah.
But you can, using the symbols, you can work. He says you can work out what
they would denote.
What these denote. And so he has this extraordinary sentence where he says the oldest known sentence in human language states. Do you want to know the oldest known sentence in human language?
I'd love to, Tom.
The bear goddess and the bird goddess are the bear goddess indeed.
It's disappointing, isn't it? I mean,
well, you may say disappointing, but I think Professor Toby Griffin would beg to disagree
I'm not shooting. He's just the messenger, Tom. I'm not shooting the messenger.
You are shooting him down. This is his great insight. He's got the oldest known sentence in human language, and you're sneering at it.
Which stone is this of the three stones I'm looking at?
Can't remember. I don't know.
You don't know. That's disappointing.
I can't remember. I think it's two lines. It's two lines with a squiggle, and it's three lines with a squiggle.
Yeah.
But his argument, and you may remember that that Milohave Vasic ends up arguing that the Vinci culture came from Greece, that it was a Greek colony.
Yeah.
And again, Professor Griffin is seizing on the parallels with Greece because he's saying, okay, well, what's a bear goddess and a bird goddess? And the figure that he fixes on is the figure of Artemis, who has bears. She associates with bears. She's the mistress of the beasts. And his argument is that this sentence is looking forward to millennia and millennia of mythological tradition that will culminate in the figure of Artemis.
This is thousands of years before Artemis, though, isn't it, Tom?
It is thousands and thousands of years before.
Yeah. I mean, that seems a massive stretch to me. I mean, even bigger stretch than the stuff about the bird.
Well,
and the bear.
You may think so, but it is an argument that has been advanced by a very eminent and very celebrated archaeologist and anthropologist called Mariha Gimbutas. Have you heard of her?
Yeah, I have. I'm very familiar with her work. I haven't.
So she is famous. I mean, yeah. She's famous as probably the most famous feminist archaeologist of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
Okay.
So she escaped the Russian occupation after the war, ended up in Berkeley in California. Mm-hmm. And she was a great enthusiast for the idea that the original peoples of what she calls old Europe, and so this is the civilization based in Serbia, that they had worshipped a mother goddess. And she argues that this culture of old Europe, that it extended as far as the Aegean, so the islands in the Aegean, it extended as far as Crete, it extended as far as Sicily, and that it was essentially peaceful. So you were asking what kind of culture did it have? Yeah. There doesn't seem to be any evidence of warfare.
So there's no weapons.
That it was egalitarian, that it was goddess-centered, and that it was matriarchal.
So hold on. She's a feminist 70s archaeologist.
She is.
And she's found something that, you know, a 70s feminist archaeologist would want to find.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so she wrote that the inhabitants of Southeastern Europe 7,000 years ago were not the primitive villages of the incipient Neolithic. Instead, they involved a unique cultural pattern contemporary with similar developments in Anatolia, Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. But her argument is that more than any of those other proto-civilizations that will go on to become, you know, the great motors of civilization.
Yeah.
That the Vinci civilization, this civilization of old Europe, as she calls it, that was the civilization that was most like a feminist hippie in California.
Yeah.
In the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. How unusual for an academic to find in the past what they would like to see in the present.
So, and the obvious question is, well, you know, she talks about civilizations of Mesopotamia or Egypt. They go on to become famous centers of civilization. So what happens to the Vinci culture? Yeah. Why does it collapse? Why has no one heard of it? What happened to it? And her argument is that it gets destroyed by the Indo-Europeans. So the Indo-Europeans are the people who linguists have worked out are the people who spread the languages that become the languages of Northern India and Europe. So it would include Sanskrit, would include ancient Greek, would include Latin, and into the contemporary, it would include Hindi, it would include Italian, and it would include English.
Right.
And big mystery, where did the Indo-Europeans come? She argues that the Indo-Europeans come from basically the region of Ukraine, actually, around Ukraine. And she argues that they're violent, they're patriarchal, they don't worship mother goddesses, they worship sky gods. So Jupiter, Zeus, Pater, the father Zeus, the father of, you know, these domineering sky gods.
Rough men.
Absolute boohiss.
Yeah.
Boohiss. So you have this peaceful, matriarchal civilization with their language and their beautiful pots and all that kind of stuff. And then these Indo-Europeans in there with their horses turn up and destroy everything.
Tom, I don't want to lapse into total self-parody. I mean, frankly, that ship has probably sailed many podcasts ago. And nor do I want to appear like I'm just the miserable skeptic who doesn't know anything about prehistoric history and is just pouring scorn on everything. But that sounds like total tosh to me. It just sounds like complete wish fulfillment.
Actually, I think it's total tosh, but I think that it is a kind of Rorschach test.
Yeah.
And I think that just as with, you know, forgeries, it takes maybe a few decades before you can recognize the period where the forgery is painted. So, you know, if you have a Renaissance painting that's forged in the 1920s, you know, it could take you 50 years before you look at it and say, that's a very, you know, that was clearly painted in the 1920s.
Yeah.
I think in a similar way, perhaps with academic fashion, particularly when it's something like prehistory, where the evidence is so sparse,
yeah,
and it can take time perhaps for you to see that academic fashions are, yeah, absolutely reflective of broader cultural and social trends.
For the last 5 minutes, I felt like I'm trapped in a California seminar room in 1974.
Well, so today, the consensus among archaeologists about this is what happened to the Venetian civilization is that they weren't overthrown by a violent invasion, that the Indo-Europeans, when they came, that it was a much more peaceful process of integration.
That's all the rage now with academics, yeah.
And also that the Venetian civilization were destroyed by basically environmental degradation.
I was just
that
about
they exhausted
to say,
the soils and they wiped out wildlife.
Do you know, before you started that sentence, I thought to myself, I'll jump in and I'll say, I bet academics now think it was climate change. And of course they do.
So the argument is that it's climate change or it's environmental degradation, and that there was no violent invasion by immigrants, but that they were peacefully integrated.
Kindly multiculturalism.
So I'm, who knows? Again, I just don't think that probably that the evidence is there. But again, I suspect that perhaps in 50 years, people will look back and say, well,
of course, people in 2020,
you know, that's, yeah, very reflective of broader intellectual and cultural opinions.
So the great thing about the Vinci culture then, Tom, is that it's actually a window into changing.
Yeah, it's as interesting about academia in, yeah, the 20th and 21st century as it is about, I mean, actually, you know, it's an amazing civilization. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it is incredible. These settlements do exist. The copper smelting did happen. These weird squiggles, you know, it doesn't matter if they're a language or not. I mean, there's something weird going on there.
Yeah, yeah,
the,
yeah,
art is incredible. The figurative stuff is incredible. When we advertise this, I will put up, you know, images from it. It is there. But I just don't think that it would seem that we know enough to arrive at a conclusive opinion either way.
We should sort of end the podcast not by talking about academic fashion, but by talking about the civilization itself. So, of course, you're not, you know, a sort of card carrying, massively specialized expert on this.
No, I literally found out about it a week ago.
Well, that's all you need. I mean, that's all you need. Come on. But what do you think? Because you know a lot about sort of Neolithic stuff and all that.
I know
business.
That I don't know. I know, okay, that I don't know. But what I would say is that
the dates are right.
I was
they?
Really astounded.
Yeah.
I had not expected that. And what also surprises me is that it's not better known.
Well, that's astounding, isn't it? That it's not
because
better known.
This really isn't kind of on the radar.
But that's because it's in Serbia, right? So if it was in Britain, in Germany, in France,
yeah,
it'd be a big tourist destination. There'd be a huge visitor centre.
Well, and I think there'd probably be a kind of slightly nationalist strain.
Of course there would. Kids would do it in primary school.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they? Absolutely, yeah, they would. People would dress up as members of the Vinci, as matriarchs.
Yeah. Yes. That's the problem. You have to, it's very difficult to extrapolate from the found, you know, from the remains that have been found, any sense of how these function and what happened to them.
Yeah.
And that's why I think they're vulnerable to kind of trends.
But there's also that extraordinary mystery about the disappearance. Because, I mean, for such a civilization so far ahead of its time to have flourished and then vanished.
Okay, so that's one final thing, is that the two leading figures in the study of this, so Milahe Vasic and Mariha Gimbutas, that, you know, these are the two top names in the field. Both of them are absolutely alert to a feeling that something about this culture ends up being expressed in Minoan and Cycladic, so the civilization of kind of pre-classical Aegean.
Yeah.
And Gimbutas's argument that the Indo-Europeans come in and they, you know, they wipe the floor with the Vinci culture and it all gets obliterated. Her argument is that traces of this survive on islands in the Aegean. So on Crete, in the Cyclades in the Aegean. And, you know, there do seem to be, to my untrained eye, there do seem to be similarities. And obviously these two great figures involved in the study of this culture, mm-hmm, sense that as well.
Yeah.
You know, and they spent a lifetime studying it. So
not a week.
Who am I to sneer at it? So I think there is something mysterious there.
God, what a fascinating story.
You know, if there are scholars listening to this who are specialists in it, let us know what you think.
Tom, I sincerely hope there haven't been scholars listening to this. There's no way. Specialists in it. Can you visit it? Can you go and see, is there a museum in Serbia?
Yeah, there are, yeah.
Gosh, we should do a Rest Is History Serbian tour.
I'm so thrilled that you finally got
my
interested
heart
in history.
It plummeted like a stone when you turned out you weren't going to do Stefan Dušan. And actually, this was brilliant. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, well, thanks, Tom.
I learned a lot, and I love these. I love it when we end a podcast by just basically saying we don't know and we'll probably never know. And that sense of the mystery of the past, I think, is really important. And when we're claiming to, as we often do on this podcast, to know everything, we don't really. So it's great to end in the sort of the mists of time.
Known unknowns.
Yes, known unknowns. There you go. I'm all about the mist of time. Tom is all about Donald Rumsfeld. That's the dynamic that has made this podcast beloved by both its listeners. And we'll be back, won't we, Tom? With more World Cup known unknowns next time.
And that's a known known. We'll see you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest Is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.